This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna rabbakumu Allahu الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
It's our top stories. The U.S. Secretary of State says Washington is set to designate Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization. The U.S. House is set to vote on a resolution calling on the Vice President and the Cabinet to remove President Trump from office before his impeachment. Also ahead this hour, the number of COVID-19 infections in the Gaza Strip is on the rise as the enclave struggles with an Israeli blockade. We'll have a report from Gaza. Our top story this hour, the United States has blacklisted Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the designation will take effect on January the 19th. In his statement, Pompeo has accused Yemen's Houthis of terrorist acts. He says the group has threatened civilian populations and commercial shipping with cross-border attacks. The top U.S. diplomat says the group continues to destabilize the region and obstruct a peaceful solution to the conflict in Yemen. The Houthis took control of the capital Sana'a and much of Yemen's north in 2014 after the then-government resigned. A year later, Saudi Arabia and some of its allies launched an air campaign to push the movement out of power. Saudi-led aggression has left tens of thousands of civilians dead. Let's discuss this issue a little bit further with Mr. Tim Anderson. He's the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, who joins us via Skype out of Sydney, Australia. Mr. Anderson, it's good to have you with us. Your understanding on the issue, please. You know, given the fact that, you know, groups like this are, it's not as if that they were not sanctioned from before. Some people may argue that what they have done, what the U.S. has actually done, is could only be ceremonial.
The genocidal blockade on Yemen and the war, driven by the United States through their main ally, Saudi Arabia, has created the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And this little bit of doublespeak, trying to say that the Ansarullah-led coalition, which has been effectively the government of Yemen for the last 5 years at least, trying to turn it around and say that they are somehow a threat to other people. They have been defending their own country, and yes, they've retaliated against the Saudis, but to call it terrorist is really to turn the meaning of the word upside down. I think we're getting used to that with the way the US views the world, particularly as they're coming to designate entire states like the IRGC in Iran or Cuba or Venezuela or now Yemen as terrorists, and it means they can justify any form of aggression against those countries. So the US is the master of this, trying to turn language on its head.
Ron Sarolai is actually has been resisting, but the question is, do you think that this act will, or if it does, in what way do you think it hinders the performance and the operations by Ansarullah, or does it really?
Not in relation to the Yemeni government, the coalition led by Ansarullah. What it may do, and this is really what they're stating in the dying days of the Trump regime, is to try and deter other people from trading or breaking the blockade or sending food or medical supplies, or intimidate others, in other words, from dealing with Sana'a and dealing with the effective government of Yemen. And that's going to worsen, as I said, this genocidal blockade that has caused the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Pompeo is saying we're going to worsen that crisis and punish the Yemeni people for resisting.
Because you spoke about the lame duck state that the Trump administration basically has right now. You know, apart from making it perhaps difficult for the incoming administration to have to follow the Trump policies, at least for a while, are you hopeful, or do you think that this would be perhaps one of the first acts or an important act by the incoming U.S. president to undo?
Well, it is an opportunity for the Biden administration to show that it's different to the Trump administration, but we also know that in many respects the Trump administration carried on the Obama-Biden administration of dirty wars across the region, including in Yemen. This began before the Trump administration came around. So, nevertheless, out with the old, in with the new, it's an opportunity for the Biden administration to demonstrate if it has some other option, if it's able to show any form of goodwill. There is an opportunity there.
All right. Many thanks, Mr. Tim Anderson, Director for Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies out of Sydney, Australia. I really appreciate your time, sir. Calls for the U.S. president's removal from office are getting louder after Wednesday's deadly raid of the Capitol building by pro-Donald Trump protesters. Democrats are spearheading an impeachment proposal against the president, blaming him for inciting the violent siege on the Capitol. 210 lawmakers have so far become the co-sponsors of the measure. This would make Trump the first U.S. president ever to be impeached twice. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, however, said the lawmakers would first vote on a resolution calling on Vice President Mike Pence, that is, to invoke the 25th Amendment. The article allows for a president's immediate unseating if he is deemed unfit to serve. The siege left at least six people, including two police officers, dead. Federal authorities have made dozens of arrests on several charges, including domestic terrorism. Colonist and political scientist Wilmer Leon says U.S. President Donald Trump should be taken to task for the violence that occurred at the Capitol building.
I think the issue is it right or wrong? And Donald Trump encouraged treason and incited individuals to attack the Capitol. That's wrong. And as President of the United States, he needs to be held accountable for his words that resulted in violent action. And he needs to be held accountable for that. And this is an issue that has been bantered about and discussed in terms of how many members of our police department, how many members of our fire department across the country, fire departments and police departments across the country, are actually directly tied to, members of, or are sympathetic to organizations of this nature. And that is something that has to be investigated. Individuals have to be identified, and they have to be rooted out if it is determined that they are violent, as in directing their ire against the Constitution.
U.S. officials say 25 domestic terrorism cases have been opened regarding last week's attack on the Capitol building by supporters of President Donald Trump. Those under investigation are suspected of taking part in the insurrection that shut down Congress. A Pentagon official says there is concern that military members may have been involved in the riot. The Pentagon is also asked to review all members who will be a part of the security detail for the January the 20th inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. Authorities say that is to ensure they are not sympathetic to domestic terrorists. Five people, including a Capitol officer, were killed after the pro-Trump mob breached the Capitol building. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has charged nearly two dozen people with regard to Wednesday's riots. Taiwan hails the elevation of relations with the United States as Washington removes restrictions on interactions between officials from both sides. Taiwan's Foreign Minister Joseph Wu says relations between the two countries have been elevated to a global partnership. He says Taiwan seeks to boost the development of ties further. On Saturday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the change. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. is due to arrive in Taiwan on Wednesday to visit Taiwan's president and foreign minister. The move has fueled Beijing-Washington tensions. China views Taiwan as one of its provinces and is strongly opposed to increased U.S. support for it. Mr. Qingdou Xu, a senior fellow at the Pangol Institution, says Washington's decision to lift restrictions on contact with Taiwan is another provocative move against Beijing.
Very provoking. That's why Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson called the move as the final madness of this Trump administration. Usually, in the last days of administration like this, they play a role of caretaker, basically taking care of the normal business to make sure there is a power transition. Of course, there's big trouble in the U.S. The regime is in its final days, and Pompeo's days are numbered at the Secretary of State. He is making such a move. I think he's creating a trouble for the incoming administration led by Biden. So that will make Biden in a very kind of dilemma. If they want to roll back, they will face criticism for so-called being soft to Beijing. If they don't do, that will create trouble in their relationship with Beijing. And in terms of China-U.S. relations, we know that Trump and Pompeo, in particular Pompeo, I would say, in last year, he has been pushing hard for a second version of a Cold War against the rise of China. He's sort of like desperate, trying to sabotage the relationship between the two countries. Taiwan is one of the cards he has used against Beijing, along with Xinjiang, Hong Kong, Tibet, etc.
Palestinians have denounced Israel for ignoring its responsibility to ensure the availability of coronavirus vaccines to the people in the occupied territories. In a statement, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry said Israel has been committing racial discrimination by depriving Palestinians of their rights to health care. It said the attempt by the Palestinian leadership to secure the vaccines from various sources does not exempt Israel from its duties as an occupying power. The regime is facing growing criticism since it began the vaccination drive mandating officials to exclude Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority says it expects first COVID vaccine doses in March under a deal with British drug maker AstraZeneca. A top Palestinian health official says other pharmaceuticals have also been contacted for supplies.
Coronavirus infections among the general population are still rising in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The number of infections has risen to over 45,000, mostly since August of last year. Hospitals in Gaza continue to run low on intensive care units and ventilators, as well as medicines and equipment. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on Gaza's health sector.
The international community must exert real pressure on Israel Israel to end its illegal blockade of Gaza and allow local authorities to combat the coronavirus pandemic. The international community must also provide badly needed medical aid to the overwhelmed health sector in Gaza, which is already in a bad shape and struggling to fight the coronavirus.
The pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip, threatening the socio-economic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
People here are terrified by the rapid spread of coronavirus infections. Our hospital lack of vital equipment and medicines, and our health system has been battered by the Israel blockade.
The economy has been hit hard by the pandemic, and people are afraid and hardly have any income. Nowadays, it is very hard to maintain a business because of the tight restrictions.
Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the spread of COVID-19. They currently impose lockdowns from 8 p.m. until 7 a.m. and a complete curfew on Fridays and Saturdays.
The emergency measures, including lockdowns, will continue in order to fight the spread of the virus. We call on everyone to stay at home during the lockdowns and abide by safety measures.
Human rights groups have repeatedly warned of the catastrophic implications of coronavirus spread in the Gaza Strip.
Experts say Israel's inhumane practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to fight the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The number of daily coronavirus fatalities in Iran has plunged to its lowest level in over 7 months. The Iranian Health Ministry reported 71 new deaths on Sunday, the fewest since early June. The ministry also confirmed just under 6,000 new infections in the past 24 hours. Overall, the country has registered nearly 1.3 million COVID cases and over 56,000 fatalities. Iran imposed tight restrictions almost 2 months ago. It later extended the curbs to include lower-risk cities to sustain the fall in the number of new infections and deaths. The country has also launched human trials of its domestically developed COVID-19 vaccine late last month. Uman Abedi in Tehran says the current declining trend in coronavirus numbers signals better days are ahead for the people of Iran.
As far as I'm concerned, I think better days would come because, these are this decrease of number in fatalities and infection cases is the result of the restrictions imposed by the government and the task force to combat the coronavirus, especially the night curfew in many cities of Iran, and of course ban of commuting between the major cities of Iran. Of course, we should not forget that the cooperation and collaboration of the people should not be forgotten in this regard, because the main part of this thing was that people cooperated with the government and the task force, and they listened to what they were advising them to do.
Brazil's weekly moving average of fatalities per day has surpassed 1,000 for the first time since early August. The figure comes while COVID-19 cases continue to surge in the South American nation, which is the world's second worst-hit country in terms of deaths. Brazilian Health Ministry on Sunday registered nearly 30,000 new cases of the virus, raising the total number of infections to more than 8.1 million. Authorities there also reported some 470 additional COVID-19 fatalities, bringing the overall death toll to more than 203,000. The developments come amid growing pressure on Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro to speed up the vaccine rollout. Bolsonaro has come under harsh criticism not only for his government's mishandling of the pandemic, but also for inability to correctly distribute and administer sufficient doses of vaccine. While the world struggles to contain the COVID-19 pandemic, a new and more contagious variant of the coronavirus is fast spreading across dozens of nations. Russian media have reported that the first case of the more infectious strain, which was initially found in Britain, has been detected in a man who returned from the UK. Russia suspended flights to Britain last month until January the 13th and introduced a mandatory 2-week self-isolation period for people arriving from that country. Russia has so far recorded nearly 61,000 COVID-19 deaths out of over 3.3 million confirmed cases. Meanwhile, Japan also detected the first or the new variant in four travelers from Brazil, I should say. The country has so far posted around 290,000 cases and over 4,000 fatalities. Remaining with the issue, the German chancellor has warned that the coming weeks will be the hardest phase of the coronavirus pandemic for her country.
There is this dangerous second wave of the pandemic that our country is in, like so many European countries. These next weeks of winter will probably be the most difficult phase of the pandemic.
Merkel's comments come as Germany's death toll from the coronavirus topped 40,000 on Sunday. Britain, the same day, reported 563 new deaths. That pushes its total virus fatalities to above 81,000. The UK Health Secretary says every day 200,000 people are being vaccinated against coronavirus there. Matt Hancock said the country aims to vaccinate 15 million of the most vulnerable people by mid-February. In Italy, the number of COVID deaths have surpassed 78,700. And that's it with international news.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Merciful, the all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has indicated that she was ready to start second impeachment proceedings against President Donald Trump unless he was removed from office. The House is prepared to launch impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump as early as this week if Vice President Mike Pence and the Cabinet refuse to remove him from office for his role in inciting a mob that carried out a deadly assault on the seat of American government. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, Pelosi Says House Will Proceed with Efforts to Remove Trump with Urgency. Stay with us for more of Lauren Gambino's article. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has indicated that she was ready to start second impeachment proceedings against President Donald Trump unless he was removed from office. The House is prepared to launch impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump as early as this week if Vice President Mike Pence and the Cabinet refuse to remove him from office for his role in inciting a mob that carried out a deadly assault on the seat of the American government. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi delivered the ultimatum in a letter to colleagues on Sunday night, 10th of January, that described the president as an urgent threat to the nation. On Monday, the House moved forward with a non-binding resolution that calls on Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment and strip Donald Trump of his presidential authority. If the measure fails to receive unanimous support, as is expected, the House will vote on the resolution on Tuesday, 12th of January. Mike Pence, she said, would have just 24 hours to respond. Next, Nancy Pelosi said the House will proceed with bringing impeachment legislation to the floor. Though she did not specify an exact timeline, top Democrats have suggested the House could begin proceedings as soon as midweek. In protecting our Constitution and our democracy, we will act with urgency because this president represents an imminent threat to both, she wrote. As the days go by, the horror of the ongoing assault on our democracy perpetrated by this president is intensified, and so is the immediate need for action. Pelosi noted urgency was required because Trump was due to leave office on 20th of January. She explained that the resolution called on Mike Pence to convene and mobilize the cabinet to activate the 25th Amendment to declare the president incapable of executing the duties of his office. Under the procedure, the vice president would immediately exercise powers as acting president, she wrote. Sunday, 10th of January, Nancy Pelosi told 60 Minutes Donald Trump was a deranged, unhinged, dangerous president of the United States, adding that he has done something so serious that there should be prosecution against him. Mike Pence is not expected to take the lead in forcing Donald Trump out, although talk has been circulating about the 25th Amendment option for days in Washington. Earlier, it had been speculated that the House Democrats could try to introduce articles of impeachment as early as Monday. One touted strategy was to condemn the president's actions swiftly but delay an impeachment trial in the Senate for 100 days. That would allow President-elect Joe Biden to focus on other priorities as soon as he is inaugurated on 20th of January. Jim Clyburn, the third-ranking House Democrat and a top ally of Joe Biden, laid out the ideas on Sunday as the country came to grips with the siege of the Capitol by Donald Trump loyalists trying to overturn the election results. Let's give President-elect Biden the 100 days he needs to get his agenda off and running, Jim Clyburn said. The push by House Democrats came after the office of the Colorado Democratic Representative Jason Crow released a readout of a call in which Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy indicated that the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, is aware of further possible threats posed by would-be terrorists in the days up to and including Inauguration Day. According to the readout, Ryan McCarthy said the Pentagon was working with local and federal law enforcement to coordinate security preparations for 20th of January. Democratic Representative Jason Crow, a former U.S. Army Ranger, said he had raised grave concerns about reports that active duty and reserve military members were involved in the insurrection and asked that troops deployed for the inauguration are not sympathetic to domestic terrorists. The readout said Ryan McCarthy agreed and said he was willing to testify publicly in the coming days. On Sunday, Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania joined colleague Lisa Murkowski of Alaska in calling for Donald Trump to resign and go away as soon as possible. I think the president has disqualified himself from ever certainly serving in office again, Pat Toomey said. I don't think he's electable in any way. Lisa Murkowski, who has long voiced her exasperation with Donald Trump's conduct in office, told the Anchorage Daily News on Friday that Trump simply needs to get out. A third Republican, Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, did not go that far, but on Sunday, he warned Donald Trump to be very careful in his final days in office. Corporate America began to tie its reaction to the Capitol riots by tying them to campaign contributions. Citigroup's head of global government affairs, Candy Wolf, said in a Friday memo to employees, "We want you to be assured that we will not support candidates who do not respect the rule of law." House leaders, furious after the insurrection, appear determined to act against Donald Trump despite the short timeline. Another idea being considered was to have a separate vote that would prevent Donald Trump from ever holding office again. That could potentially only need a simple majority vote of 51 senators, unlike impeachment, in which two-thirds of the 100-member Senate must support a conviction. The Senate was set to be split evenly at 50-50, but under Democratic control, once Vice President-elect Kamala Harris and two Democrats who won Georgia's Senate runoff elections last week are sworn in. Kamala Harris would be the Senate's tie-breaking vote. The FBI and other agencies are continuing their examination of the circumstances of the insurrection, including allegations that Pentagon officials loyal to Donald Trump blocked the deployment of National Guard troops for 3 hours after officials called for help. "We couldn't actually cross over the border into Washington, D.C. without the okay, and that was quite some time coming," the Republican governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, told CNN. Larry Hogan added, "Eventually I got a call from the Secretary of the Army asking if we could come into the city, but we had already been mobilized, we already had our police, we already had our guard mobilized, and we were just waiting for that phone call."
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to Economic Divide with Mika Batahlai. To start off the year, we're going to be taking a look at the Saudi Arabian budget deficit, a deficit that has a sum of around $79 billion, something that will no doubt pinch the pockets of the world's largest oil producer. Now, for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the reliance on oil is something that is reflected heavily in its GDP. Yet, as we can see from this chart over here, the impact of the coronavirus on oil prices around the world was the second largest fall in history, when in March 2020, prices fell by 31.5%. So, how did the oil crash affect the Saudi GDP? Again, let's refer to this next graph that you see over here. We can see that until Q3 of 2019, that's the bar that you see here on Q3, GDP had a positive growth rate, yet with the arrival of the COVID-19 virus and a global fall in the demand for oil, the Saudi GDP slipped, with Q2 seeing a 7.5% drop. That is reflected over here for Q2, and then moving on to Q3, that dropped to around 4%, as you see in this chart. Now, with uncertainty still surrounding a recovery, no wonder things are looking down for the Saudis. Let's now take a look at our first report and look at the global oil crash in more detail and see just how Saudi Arabia has been hit the hardest.
Things were looking very rosy for the bank account of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia over the last decade. With 266 billion barrels of proven oil reserves, the boom times certainly allowed the dollars to flow into the nation, allowing the despotic Saudi royal family to rule a reign of lavish luxury, whilst letting ordinary citizens slip into poverty. But in 2020, the world woke up to the impact of the COVID-19 crisis, a world pandemic that would affect the health and lives of millions and bring economies to their knees, and things were no different for the Saudis. Whereas the KSA has not been immune to the virus in terms of human costs, in fact, with 363,000 cases recorded and over 6,200 deaths, it's the impact on the economy that's truly hit home with Riyadh, with the GDP falling some 7.5% since the start of 2020. The reason for this has been the sharp drop in the price of oil, as the virus has clearly demonstrated over the last 12 months, the demand for fuel has slipped, falling from $71.34 a barrel in 2018 to a year low of just $9.12 per barrel in 2020, something that the Saudis were not expecting, it seems, as the national budget deficit is now a staggering $79 billion. To add insult to the injury, an economic war was triggered in March 2020 between the Saudi regime and Russia, with oil prices at the heart of the battle. The price sparked a quarterly fall of 65% in oil prices, with crude and Brent falling around 25%. The resulting oil war, as well as the effect of the COVID-19 virus, sparked a global stock market crash, costing trillions. With the world still yet to recover from the various impacting factors in 2020, things are not looking too bright for Saudi Arabia, with oil prices still low and a budget deficit that has hurt its economy.
Joining me in the studio today is Atife Padidar. Atife, welcome and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us here today. Okay, now before we get into details about the Saudi oil crisis, we spoke to Hossein Askari. He's a professor of international business at the George Washington University, and he's also a former board member on the IMF, and he was an advisor to the Saudi Ministry of Finance. Well, let's listen to what he said about how the crash has affected the Saudi economy and how the average Saudi is faring now compared to the so-called boom years.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's very nice to be with you. Let me just back up and say that when you look at the Saudi economy, it is very heavily oil dependent. Roughly 80% of Saudi Arabia's exports are oil, and about another 10% are oil related, namely plastics and petrochemicals. So when oil prices go down, Saudi Arabia is in trouble. And then the second issue is that the revenues of the country, government revenues, is about 75% comes from oil. And so when oil prices again goes down, government revenues goes down. And Saudi Arabia at the same time has some fixed expenditures that it tries to make. And those, I can list those, but basically, you know, the important ones are domestic subsidies, military expenditures, also money for the large ruling family of Saudi Arabia, which is probably around 17,000 people. All of these things cost money, and so they have to spend that. So the country basically then runs into deficits, and Saudi Arabia has budget deficits of roughly 10-12% recently. So this is not sustainable, and so when this happens, the simple guy on the road, on the streets, get actually squeezed. And so what you have to do, they can't squeeze them too much because then you have domestic problems, and so they run deficits. That's where it's at.
Okay, very well. Atifah, with Saudi Arabia so heavily dependent on oil, as we know, how do you think that the price drop has impacted the economy there and in total or overall the Saudi regime? And also, do you think that the Saudi economy is going to be suffering as a result of this, and for what length of time? Some have said could be a few years.
Well, definitely, Saudi oil income contributes to two-thirds of its public revenue. So less oil money means financial trouble in public sectors, which directly affects the people of Saudi Arabia. Now, the government might start introducing measures like rising taxes. They have started with VAT and introducing some austerity measures, which will not be welcomed by people of Saudi Arabia. They're not accustomed to this sort of situation. At the moment, a lot of people in Saudi Arabia are critical of the government because of the rising unemployment, which will continue due to these financial difficulties. And a lot of them are saying that this situation could be prevented if the government would spend less on military and stop the war in Yemen, which brought them nothing but international condemnation, and focus that money on their people, this situation wouldn't be happening.
Okay, very well. Thanks for that. Well, let's take a look now at how Saudi Arabia is trying to move away from their reliance on oil, as bin Salman, the crown prince, tries to modernize the country, albeit to some quite rightly skeptical views from foreign nations of Saudi human rights records.
Bin Salman, the crown prince of the Saudi regime, ousted his nearest rivals in a bloodless coup that essentially made him the de facto ruler of the kingdom, going as far as imprisoning some of his relatives and even killing people who spoke out against him, none more so infamous than the brutal fashion in which the journalist Jamal Khashoggi met his fate at the hands of bin Salman's murder hit squad. Part of the regime that bin Salman wished to implement under his rule was the so-called 2030 vision, a plan that would see the kingdom introduce a strategic framework designed to reduce the nation's dependence on oil and concentrate on other sources of income. Many question whether this will be a success, with certain examples already proving to be a failure, with various sporting personalities refusing to attend high-profile events in the country. However, some have agreed, and some academics feel that the move away from oil onto more diverse projects has potential to succeed.
I think that the new approach, which is reflected in the broader 2030 vision, if implemented as outlined, it will take off. Now, that is contingent in on the government and the leaders implementing, creating the enabling environment, which is very key for you to take off. This will include, of course, some of the things that is already outlined in the vision. In particular, a continuation with the development of infrastructure.
But for bin Salman and his grand idea, there still lies several fundamental flaws in his approach. Firstly, as we've discussed, is the shocking history of human rights in the country, as seen in the murder of Khashoggi, but also the inequality between men and women, the notion of modern slavery in the kingdom, the terrible ongoing destruction of Yemen, and of course, the infighting between Saudi royals themselves, all lead many to question as to just how far this project can go before it collapses. The idea, however, is something that other nations in the Persian Gulf region have also considered adopting, with the likes of the United Arab Emirates, for example, branching out into fields of tourism and technology, and the Persian Gulf state of Qatar, which is also thriving outside of its gas income, with the FIFA World Cup heading to Qatar next year, and of course the highly successful aviation industry, spearheaded by award-winning Qatar Airways, notably the only operator to thrive during the COVID-19 pandemic.
If you look at the Gulf countries, they both seem to have taken quite a similar path. They all seem to have developed a broader economic and political and social kind of framework with the arrangement. And I think the difference is that the pace of development is quite maybe slightly different, or the pace of the implementation is quite slightly different.
Joining us back in the studio is Hossein Askari. Professor, Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf states have taken huge steps to move away from economic reliance on oil, coming up with a range of alternative economic plans. Do you think that this tactic will work, or will setup costs prove too costly?
Well, I think that eventually, of course, oil runs out. And so any country has got to do something to make sure that this oil lasts in some fashion. Now, I am a firm believer in Islamic economics and what the Quran teaches about finance and economics. And it's very, very clear, no one with any brain can dispute this, that in Islam, what is under the ground, namely depletable resources, belong equally to all members of the present and future generations. But let me just say this, to be able to transform your economy from oil to something else, you need more than just a vision. You need more than just somebody saying, we're going to do this. You need to create a setup in a country where there is the rule of law and where there are incentives for the private sector to develop those things. Saudi Arabia has not done that. And so when you try to, as a government, to try to set the direction for how you're going to go from an oil economy to a non-oil economy, it's very difficult for the government to say, well, we're going to pick this particular sector, that particular sector, and invariably it doesn't work. And until you have a setup, an environment, the condition for the private sector to flourish, and Saudi Arabia does not have that. So I think it'll be a very costly mistake in the long run, because it has not done the spade work in order to set up for a resurgence of the private sector.
Okay, not too optimistic for Saudi Arabia. Atifa bin Salman has stated that he wants to diversify the Saudi economy, said that many times. And, of course, he's talked about this 2030 vision that Professor there also talked about, the aim to boost tourism, infrastructure, leisure, recreation, things of that nature. But there have already been several boycotts of Mohammed bin Salman, really, in particular, and Saudi Arabia as a whole, by the idea about these big brand names who and stars who want to actually make advancements, but they're concerned about the human rights record of Saudi Arabia. Do you think that this plan, this vision is going to work? Or do you think that Saudi Arabia actually has too many skeletons in its closet?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman established his authority through massive crackdowns on the dissent, locking up competitors in luxury hotels, ordering the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, waging a war in Yemen, and being involved in a blockade on Qatar. Now, these sort of behaviors discourage many investors, and a lot of investors in the future are thinking, is this a man that we want to work, a pro-violence, anti-democracy guy? They're looking for safe places to invest, especially with the ongoing pandemic and the financial crisis across the globe. So I don't think that the investors are going to be encouraged to invest in this vision. And at the same time, Bin Salman was heavily reliant on the income from oil to make this dream happen. And with the drop in the oil revenues and the ongoing pandemic, I think his dream is dying away.
Okay, very well. Well, we're about to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere, as we have plenty more coming up, including more from Atife and a new section of our show. It's called 1,000 Words. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavitah Hawaii. Time now to take a look at a change of policy in Arab Persian Gulf states in our in-depth section. Now, as we have seen in recent months, several nations have normalized ties with the Israel regime, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Many suggest that the Saudi regime may also follow the trend, but Riyadh appears to be stalling for now. Well, according to a report by Karen Uziel of Focus Economics, which was cited in this entry, she has stated that the biggest winner of the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime will be the poorest nation, that being Sudan. Yet between Israel, the UAE, and the U.S., a $3 billion fund promoting economic development will be launched, which may also tempt the Saudis. Now, she also has stated that for Saudi Arabia to fully and officially normalize ties with Israel will mean a change of power at the top, believing that bin Salman will have to replace his father for that to happen, which may spark huge protests and then in the process let down the people of Palestine. Well, the Israeli regime has offered to sweeten the deal with the Saudis by offering them an incentive, namely providing the so-called Iron Dome missile system once ties are normalized. The Saudi regime will no doubt at due time, due to his love of weapons, may jump at this, but for now it has rejected it. Well, Israel itself is desperate for business. For example, check out this entry over here, an Israeli-Saudi Silicon Wadi to benefit both. Now, this is for the tech sector. An Israeli-Saudi union here will obviously benefit both, but Israel is looking to expand itself because of the fact that COVID-19 has affected countries around the world, and one of the main sources of income for the Saudis was the U.S. Cybersecurity, for example, is one of the fields, not to mention agritech, fintech, and digital health.
They say the difference between a man and a boy is the price of his toys. And this is no different for bin Salman, who since taking pseudo charge of the country has spent billions on military hardware, ranging from the latest fighter jets to the most devastating bombs, most of which come from Western suppliers, and in particular, the United States of America. But the military deals taking place are riddled with corruption, hence proving why so much spending has left the kingdom with such a huge deficit, all caused by the bad deals that allow certain individuals to profit in the process.
There have been, in fact, some military contracts in which the commission was larger than the actual contract, namely over 100%. There have been military contracts in which later on what are called the add-ons were larger than the initial contract, which also tells you that there was corruption going on, so they had to basically later on come and add money to it to make up for it, namely the contractor was told what was the highest other bid so that or the lowest other bid, I'm sorry, so they could go below that. So there are all of these things why the military contracts occur.
However, for the cameras, the corruption is not an issue, as the likes of Trump and bin Salman laugh and joke about billion-dollar contracts, which Trump labelled as peanuts to the Saudi regime. The final destination of the weapons and bombs bought from the US and the UK is no laughing matter. Bin Salman's also been the mastermind and chief instigator of the ongoing war in Yemen, where the very deals signed by the Saudis to buy US weapons has seen over 233,000 people killed in the country at the hands of Saudi attacks and sanctions. With the war looking like an unwinnable mission for Riyadh, it seems that the excessive spending on military hardware, some of which has never been used, either through lack of knowledge as to how to use it, or simply not having had the opportunity to do so, has meant that the overall budget on the war has brought few tangible gains for the Saudi military, with estimates placing the Saudi spending on the war in Yemen being at around $200 million per day. It's no wonder then that the Saudi budget has run down.
We're joined back in the studio with Atafe, but before we head into our discussion, let's hear one more time from Professor Hossein Askari. We asked him a question about the Saudi military program.
The military expenditures, it's done for a variety of reasons. Let's just be very frank about it. Saudi Arabia cannot really defend itself, but it does not have anyone who wants to invade it. And if anyone does invade it, Saudi Arabia will get the backing of the United States military, and now I believe of Israel's. So why do they spend all this money on military? Well, I think it's number one is to reward the U.S. military complex, because the United States wants to export military hardware that reduces the cost of every unit that the U.S. military then buys. There's a second reason, and that is corruption. Is that in fact the commissions that are paid in military contracts are enormous. They run into the billions. So it's a way to channel money to various people inside and outside Saudi Arabia. I believe that much of that equipment is not against foreigners, but is to be used eventually if there is a domestic disturbance. And so it is prepositioned for Americans to come and help the Saudi family out.
Hey, he's a great guest for this program. Okay. We have seen Donald Trump accepting billions of dollars from the Saudi regime, obviously in return for what the professor said there, for military weapons. This week actually saw another $290 million of arms being sold to Saudi Arabia, well, approved to be sold to Saudi Arabia. And this is a last push by Trump to arm, obviously, his friend, especially Mohammed bin Salman. Now, do you think that incoming President Joe Biden, if he does actually get confirmed, is he going to be following Trump's footsteps, do you think?
Well, Saudi Arabia has been the United States' greatest ally in this region. I don't think that alignment is going to change with Biden coming to the office. But I think Biden is a man who cares about his international image, so he would be more careful the way he treats Saudi Arabia. But in terms of economic trades, I think there are going to be more trade deals between these two countries, especially now that the United States is in financial trouble itself. But in other things, I think regarding the human rights issues, Biden would be more careful to address these issues, things that, for example, Bin Salman does, you know, the thing that he does. I think that's the only thing that would be would change. That's it.
Very well. Thank you very much for your input. We appreciate it. Atif Paidar, researcher and journalist. Sure. The Saudi regime is run by a family that appears to be living a lavish lifestyle, fueled by oil sales that provide easy income to spend on luxury goods, sophisticated military weapons, and most worryingly of all, buying the silence of the Western international community following the brutal assassination of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But it seems that the impact of the coronavirus and the slump in oil prices have left the bank vaults of the Saudi regime